Renegade economists Marilyn Waring, Kate Raworth, and Elena Ostrom, a TUC radio miniseries on how to resist the demands of permanent economic growth and protect the earth, indigenous communities, local agriculture, and women. Kate Raworth, Why It's Time for a New Version of Human Prosperity. Kate Raworth came to international attention in 2017 with the publication of her most recent book, Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. She critiques the gross domestic product system of accounting, including the so-called green or sustainable growth models. As you listen to her talk to health professionals in London in December 2016, imagine 2 circles, one inside the other, forming a hole in the middle. That's the donut. Based on the work of Earth system scientists, Kate Raworth graphs 9 planetary boundaries into the outer ring. They spell danger when crossed. Among them are climate change, ocean acidification, water depletion, chemical pollution, etc. The problem is that we already overshot the limits of at least 4 of the 9 boundaries. Inside the smaller circle, in what we call the donut hole, she places a graphic representation of people without health care, food, water, education, a job, access to energy, and more. In Kate Raworth's donut model, the goal is to raise the well-being of humans trapped inside the donut hole while placing limits on climate change and pollution that are near or have crossed the outer circle of the donut. Kate Raworth is teaching at Oxford University's Environmental Change Institute and at the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. Over the last 2 decades, she has worked as senior researcher at Oxfam and as co-author of the United Nations Human Development Report. In this talk, she refers to her co-presenter, Kevin. That's Kevin Anderson. He's a frequent guest on TUC Radio. And she offers an apology to the audience. Here's Kate Raworth.
I know it's early in the day, and I apologize for bringing junk food into the room already, especially to health professionals. I've had so many medics and doctors write to me saying, I love your concept, but did you have to call it a donut? Do you know how unhealthy these are? So all I can say is perhaps I'm going to introduce you to the one donut that might actually turn out to be good for us. And I hope I can explain why. So in the 20th century, the shape of progress was very simple. It was this ever-rising line measured in GDP growth. It's the dominant paradigm, the dominant metric. We hear it in our politicians' language every day. The trouble is, it brought 2 things uncomfortably with it. It's brought extraordinary inequality. Now just 62 billionaires own the same wealth as the poorest half of the world's population and sail around in these very high-carbon ships. And at the same time, it's brought extraordinary degradation, which Kevin has just spoken so eloquently and passionately about. And this is a very uncomfortable problem to have when you live by a growth paradigm. So what can our politicians do with that? It's clear that they are searching for a better language to describe what progress looks like while they're still wedded to growth. And I call it playing growth bingo. So I listen every time I hear a politician talking about growth. What word do they stick in front of it? So Angela Merkel has talked about sustained growth. Barack Obama wants long-term lasting growth. David Cameron called for balanced growth. But you can have it good, you can have it green, smart, smarter growth, equitable, inclusive growth, anything you like, just so long as it's growth. Of course, some of these politicians have already gone. And so I've been listening carefully to what those coming say. Theresa May just talks about economic growth. She says she wants Britain to be the greatest meritocracy in the world, but when she talks about economic growth, she doesn't add any word in front of it. I'm still trying to figure out what she's doing with this concept. But Donald Trump, he's very clear. He's stripped away all these nice adjectives. He's just pro-growth. And that's alarming because it means we're going back, we're going away from the nuance, we're going away from the change. So when it comes to change, I'm extremely inspired by the extraordinary American inventor, Buckminster Fuller, and his wide words: you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. And so in that spirit, I don't want to stick adjectives in front of growth and try and amend it, appease it, or make it more palatable. I want to come up with a completely new model. And it turns out that that model looks rather like a donut. So let me tell you what this donut is. On the outside of it, the outer ring of the donut, is, let's say, an environmental ceiling of pressure that we can put on the planet's boundaries before we tip this extraordinary, fragile, living Earth on which we depend out of the benevolent state it's been in for the last 11,700 years that's been so incredibly generous to humanity that we've managed to thrive. In 2009, a group of leading Earth system scientists got together and said, what is it about the last 11,700 years that's been extraordinarily stable phase of planet Earth's history? How can we understand what those are? And to me, these people are like planetary doctors. Medics have spent hundreds of years examining many, many, many individual human beings and learned the parameters of the human body, and that's what we call modern medicine. It's why so many of us survive. My children, I have 8-year-old twins, and when they were very little, I knew that if their temperature went above 38 or 39 degrees, I had to completely focus on bringing it back down, because we call that a fever. It's too high, and it must come back down. So we know the parameters of pressure that we can put on the human body. Well, I think of today's Earth system scientists as planetary doctors for the 21st century. But instead of hundreds of years of practice and knowledge, it's been going for about 30 years, so it's incredibly new science. And there's only one planetary body on which to experiment and explore. So it's a much trickier challenge to understand the health of our planetary body, but it's the very same questions. How many different systems are interacting? What's the equivalent of the planet's respiratory system, nervous system, muscular system, skeletal system? And how much pressure can we put on any one of those systems before we kick it out of balance and tip Earth from this benevolent phase of life into ill health for humanity for sure? And they said they believe there are 9 key Earth system processes that we have to stay within to keep ourselves within these 9 planetary boundaries. So Kevin has talked a lot about the top one there, climate change, ensuring we don't put so many greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that we cause the Earth's temperature to rise with so many extraordinarily damaging impacts. But there are others. We mustn't withdraw so much water from Earth's freshwater systems that we actually transform the hydrological cycle and stop the flow of rivers. That we mustn't put so much nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizer into cropland that leaches out. It doesn't get taken up by crops. It leaches out into the sea and lake bodies, and it causes eutrophication, changing those bodies green, absorbing all the oxygen and killing off aquatic life. Other ones include ocean acidification. So much carbon dioxide gets dissolved in oceans that it acidifies the water, killing off sea life. Chemical pollution, whether the chemical is plastic or persistent organic pollution or chemical waste or all sorts of products that humankind, these novel entities that we create, we don't yet fully understand how they interact with the fabric of life and change, even at the DNA level, change life forms. We mustn't put so many atmospheric aerosols, little tiny particulates up in the air that we see as smoke or smog. They cause smog for human health, but also they can change where the monsoon occurs. They move the monsoon patterns across countries. The ozone hole, the release of CFC gases opened up this great big hole in the ozone layer, and we know that we must then close that because the ozone layer protects us from ultraviolet light that causes skin cancer and damages so many living organisms. Biodiversity loss. If we transform the surface of Earth's land and reduce biodiversity, we not only lose an extraordinary range of living organisms, but we also create monoculture and lose the resilience that is embedded within diversity. And the lastly one on land use change, if we transform the natural state of land's Earth's surface and turn it into farmland and cities and highways, again, we're reducing Earth's capacity to absorb carbon dioxide, for sure, but also the resilience of diverse landforms. So the Earth system scientists said, we think these are the 9 planetary boundaries that we have to keep an eye on to stay within safe levels of pressure on each of them, because they're all interdependent. And if we push ourselves over these risk boundaries, we really risk kicking Earth out of the safe space that's been a human home for over 10,000 years. So where are we on those planetary boundaries? They plotted them on a chart, and you can see we're well over the climate change boundary. We're way over on the nitrogen boundary and way over on the biodiversity loss boundary. In fact, they've updated this science, and they say we're also far over on the land use change boundary and on the phosphorus boundary. So we are already over at least 4 of the boundaries. They haven't yet managed to quantify aerosol loading and chemical pollution, so we could be over on those as well. We don't know. They are huge unknowns. But we are already way over planetary boundaries. But is the answer to come right back within planetary boundaries as if we were putting no pressure on the planet? Is the answer to use no fertilizer at all, to withdraw no water from Earth's rivers and lakes? Is the answer to transform none of the Earth's land surface? No, because that would be death and disease and destruction for many millions of human beings. We have to engage with Earth's resources to provide for our own needs. So when I saw this diagram of the 9 planetary boundaries and drawn as a circle, and I was sitting in Oxfam, and some of my colleagues over there were responding to food crisis in the Sahel, and others were campaigning for health and education for all worldwide, I thought, if there are outer limits of pressure beyond which lie unacceptable environmental degradation, then so too there are inner limits of resource use and pressure, below which lie shortfalls in human well-being or human deprivation. So in that blue circle lies human deprivation in terms of the most basic needs of our lives, whether it's healthcare, food, water, education, basic income, having a job, having a voice in society, being resilient, having access to energy, and having these things with social equity and gender equality. And I crowdsourced these from the world's governments in the run-up to the Rio Plus 20 conference. So these were the 11 top priorities of more than half of the world's governments, the social priorities that they saw, and most of them, in fact, all of them, have been since embedded in the Sustainable Development Goals. Where are we on those social foundations? Well, if every human being in the world had the resources to meet their human rights, that entire inner circle would go orange. But you can see there's these blue areas of deprivation remaining. So, for example, on food, 13% of people don't have enough food to eat. For income, 21% of people live on less than $1.25 a day. So now what happens when we put these together? We've entered the 21st century already having exceeded 3, even 4 planetary boundaries. We have gone into a risk zone where we risk tipping Earth out of the stable home that it's been for us for centuries, for millennia. And yet many millions of people worldwide still cannot meet their very most basic needs. To me, this is the extraordinary indictment of the path of economic development that has been pursued over the last, and asking us, can we actually come back into this donut-shaped space, ending human deprivation and environmental degradation at the same time? And to me, this is the generational challenge. Fiona said, can we balance hope and despair? We can be desperate when we look at the extraordinary overshoot and shortfall, and we can be hopeful when we see a positive vision of a world we want to inhabit. What if we could be the generation, because as Kevin says, we have to be the generation that begins to turn this situation around, that actually starts putting humanity on track for being within the donut rather than pushing ourselves further outside of its safe and just space. So what if each of us put our own lives on a little donut-shaped table and asked ourselves, how does the way that I live impact on humanity's ability to come within this safe and just space between social and planetary boundaries? How does the way that I eat, travel, shop, bank, vote, volunteer, demonstrate, help my neighbours? How do all these ways that I live impact on social and planetary boundaries? What if every company in the world actually drew up its corporate strategy at this donut-shaped table and asked itself, is the way that we're producing product actually undermining people's human rights and pushing the planet over planetary boundaries? Or can we transform who we are as a business and what we produce and how we produce it and what we stand for so that the core practice of our business is actually helping to bring humanity into this safe and just space? There are companies today that are taking on that challenge and trying to transform their business. What if you were sitting around this table as a set of healthcare professionals asking yourselves, how could we create a healthcare system that brings humanity into this space that meets the health needs, but also the rights, the voice, the resilience, the gender equity, the social equity needs of everybody within social and planetary boundaries? What kind of healthcare system would do that? What if every urban designer, every planner building the cities of the future, because there are going to be many more, had a donut-shaped diagram on the table as a compass, as a vision for the city they wanted to build? Well, I know that might, if that sounds ridiculous. The interesting thing is that there are people doing this right now. I was contacted by a group of urban planners in Kokstad, which is the fastest growing town in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. And they said, we love this donut diagram. We took it in 2012. The municipality of our town worked together with the local youth, and we drew up a vision for our town, for what we want, for how it's going to provide for everybody's needs within planetary boundaries. And the best thing that they did, under the social foundation, they added one extra dimension, which was fun. They said, we're gonna live within social planetary boundaries. We're going to have fun while we do it. So there's the hope. But also, it's not just happening in South Africa. In Sweden, some designers contacted me, and they're designing and building a new suburb of Stockholm, about 15 minutes by train, called Kimlinge. And they said, we love this donut, and we are setting out to design the most sustainable city districts in the world. We want Kimlinge to be the first one, but we want to replicate this worldwide. So again, taking a positive vision of social and planetary integrity and saying, how can we redesign the world around this? So there's a vision, but what would it actually take to bring ourselves into this space? For me, one of the key questions we need to be asking, Kevin started asking it this morning, what key factors shape humanity's ability to move into this safe and just space? Six of them come up time and time and time again, so I'm just going to talk briefly about six of these issues. Population, inequality, aspiration, education, governance, and technology. So I'm going to start in a place that people are often afraid to talk about, with population. Because population does matter. It really matters how many of us there are. If we want to meet the human rights of all people in the world, we need to care about the number of us in total, because the more of us there are in total, the more that the requirements for meeting that social foundation are going to increase. The thing about population is it's not the one that keeps me awake at night, you see. Because in the early 1970s, Paul Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb. And population was this great scare story, as if this is the population growth curve, exponentially growing. And it looked like it was exponentially growing in the early 1970s. But actually, what population is doing is quite the opposite. It's plateauing, right? A very subtle difference of the arm from the exponential growth curve to a plateau. It's gone through an exponential phase, but it's plateauing off. And the great thing about population growth is we know how to slow down the growth rate of the human population. I'm sure all of you know, because it's got a lot to do with medicine. It's about child health, women's reproductive rights, girls' education, and women's empowerment. And these things are a magic list of factors that if you empower women and provide decent healthcare, women are empowered to take control of the size of their own families. And this is how we slow down and stabilize the growth rate and stabilize the size of the global population. So this is not the one that keeps me awake at night, because there are other things like GDP growth that are still on the exponential curve, and we haven't figured out how to make them plateau. What about inequality? I mentioned that 13% of people in the world don't have enough food to eat. How much would it actually require to give them enough food to eat? It would take 3% of today's global food supply to ensure that everybody had enough food to eat. And that is in light, right? 3%? Well, right now, 30 to 50% of food is lost post-harvest, wasted in the supply chain, or scraped off plates in the kitchen. So we're looking for 10% of what's not even being eaten at the moment. This is in one measure of the scale of extraordinary inequality that there is in the world, not just in terms of income, but access to the most basic of resources of food. Kevin already mentioned that 45% of the world's carbon emissions are produced in the name of just 10% of people. I call them the global carbonistas, and we know we're part of it. Many of us are part of the global carbonistas, living on every continent with a high carbon lifestyle. But also, one-third of the world's sustainable nitrogen budget. So if we brought nitrogen use back within what's seen as a sustainable level by planetary boundary scientists, one-third of that is used to produce meat and dairy for the EU. So kudos to the woman who wanted a lot of vegetables, to the man who said beefless diet, and the person over here called for allotments. The way we eat and the way we eat in high-income countries has a huge impact on global carbon emissions. So aspiration, I'm going to move on, for I've done population and inequality. Aspiration. We have lived through a century that has encouraged consumerism and selfish individualism. It's the PR industry. It's the advertising industry. It's the engine of consumerism that sends us out every Easter and Halloween, and here we go, Christmas, and then it'll be Valentine's Day, and then it'll be, you know, coming around. All these holidays, we're encouraged to go out. Black Friday, taking root in this country. Why are we taught to find status in what we buy and what we own? And we need to transform that to finding meaning in community, in experience, and relationships. And that experience, of course, is a picture of people hiking up a mountain. Of course, it also matters how you get there. So you can't fly in a high-carbon flight to go and have a wonderful natural experience. We need to be consistent in the whole vision of what we're doing. But transforming those aspirations, whether it's for love or for bringing care back in, this is a profound transformation. And we have been put through this century of consumerism. And, you know, step out into London, it's all around you. Advertising is everywhere. How on earth are we going to undo the lock-in, the economic lock-in of advertising and consumerism? Technology. There are many, many different technologies you could use. So on the top here, I've got pictures of different suggestions that people have used for combating climate change. You could stick mirrors in space and reflect the sunlight back, or you could stick solar panels on the roof of your house. How about supplying enough food for the world? You could encourage community gardens and enable small groups of farmers to save their own seeds and grow their own food. Or you could grow high-tech, biotech food in scientifically controlled laboratories and own seed by corporate-owned. All of these are possible solutions, but they have very, very different impacts, both on planetary boundaries and on social outcomes, social distribution and social justice in terms of voice control of technology. So they have multiple impacts. And often one of the reasons for looking at nine planetary boundaries together is because sometimes people come up with solutions for climate change which will actually aggravate problems of biodiversity loss or problems of food shortage, as Kevin was talking about, looking at in terms of the use of biomass as a means of creating a low-carbon society. All sorts of other ramifications. You cannot look at climate change in isolation from the rest of it, from the social story and the other planetary boundaries. And let's remember that behind these choices are many, many companies, whether they're fossil fuel companies, car companies, high-tech companies, food companies, with huge lobby power and lobby interest in terms of which technology is chosen. So these technologies are not being chosen in a vacuum or in terms of a calm, rational policy decision-making choice. It is strongly influenced by vested interests. Which brings me on to governance. Whether it's teamwork or collaboration, governance matters from the very local to the global. And I've just brought here one example of global governance. If we could see that picture of the planet as a video, you'd see the clouds moving continually, shifting between and over continents. They don't recognize national borders. But as humans, we have divided ourselves into these little plots of land from Afghanistan at the beginning to Zimbabwe at the end, and many, many in between that we call countries. And then we come together, whether it's at the United Nations or the Paris Agreement, and so often negotiate from short-term national self-interest and find it so hard to rise above that and seek long-term common collective global human interest for future generations as well as today's. And that's just the global governance story. And we've seen the problems of that played out over more than 20 years, resulting in the Paris Agreement, which is deeply inadequate. But there's even an agreement there. Many of the other planetary boundaries don't even have an agreement process going on. So from the local, the way you relate to your neighbours across the garden fence, that's part of governance as well. And if we can't do it with our own neighbours across our garden fences, how can we expect the United Nations to do it? So we have to transform the way we govern ourselves from the very, very local to the global. And that brings me lastly to education. And it's one I'm passionate about, particularly about economic education, but all kinds of education. We need to transform the paradigms that we're using to understand the world. So has any, if anyone here has been to an economics lecture, let's imagine if this was an economics lecture. Anybody, what was the first diagram that you would learn in economics? Shout it out. Supply and demand. There you go. You learn the supply and demand curves, right? The little crisscross of the supply and demand lines. It's magic. Kevin had a lovely picture of a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat. To me, this is economists pulling a rabbit out of a hat, because the first diagram you learn, before anyone even mentioned it, the economy apparently is the market. That is what the economy is, and it's about supply and demand. And apparently the market and prices pull the economy into equilibrium. Well, the equilibrium is just not true at all. The economy does not exist in equilibrium. It's a complex, ever-evolving, shifting system. It's not mechanical. But the economy is not just the market. There's the household economy. All of us came from household economies this morning, and anybody who got kids up today definitely came from a household economy of raising the next generation, feeding, cleaning, washing the dishes. It's reproducing ourselves as labour in the economy. But there's also the role of the state, and there's the role of the commons. So there are many forms of economy, and mainstream economics just takes us straight into the market as if that's all there is. We have to deeply enrichen our understanding of what the economy is and what it's for and who we are in it and how it moves. So I wish the first economics lecture didn't begin with supply and demand. I wish it began with the donut and the question, what kind of economy would bring humanity into this space? And that would be a completely different economics degree. And that's from my passion of reinventing education. This is where my passion lies. So I left my job at Oxfam because I wanted to pursue this even more deeply. And I've just spent the last 2 years writing a book. It's called Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. I used to be ashamed to call myself an economist because it was so inadequate as a way of understanding the world. But I'm reclaiming that word, and I call myself a renegade economist, because economics means household management. And what could we need more today than planetary household management in the interests of all of its inhabitants? So I want to reclaim the idea of what economics is and what it's for. And I very much hope I'll come across your paths in that process. Thank you very much.
That was Kate Raworth, author of the 2017 book, Donut Economics. 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. She spoke on December 10, 2016, at the conference by MedAct in London. She's teaching at Oxford University and the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. This is part 3 of a TUC Radio miniseries on renegade economics and how to resist the demands of permanent economic growth and protect the earth, indigenous communities, local agriculture, and women. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org, and the mailing address is Post Office Box 44, Calpella, with a C, like cat, Calpella, California, 95418. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.